Davila and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, and Vesta Godars. And to our camera crew, John Randolph and Kieran Krug-Meadows. And as well, Anna. Again, our website is democracynow.org. There you can see our interviews with some of the directors of the Oscar-nominated documentaries. That's democracynow.org. And we'll be broadcasting for a week of the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, January 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Freedom on My Mind, How Voting Rights Were Won in Mississippi, with post-film Poetic Justice, open mic poetry event with poet and MC John Slaughter. Freedom on My Mind chronicles the complex and compelling history of the Mississippi voter registration struggles of 1961 to 1964. The interracial nature of the campaign, the tensions and conflicts, the fears and hopes. Again, that's Freedom on My Mind, Thursday, January 14th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
My landlord's a wealthy man, living off rent like the fat of the land.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of Eviction Free 2016, a rally and march organized by Portland Tenants United. On January 15th at 4:30 p.m., tenants will gather at Portland City Hall to demand an end to no-cause evictions, landlord retaliation, and persistent discrimination against racial minorities. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Hello, neighbors, if you try to stop an eviction, I'd be by your side. Hello, neighbors, you know you should fight for a right for the common good.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a judge in Washington State reverses his decision to allow oil-trained protesters to claim the so-called necessity defense.
Governor Kate Brown proposes her own Oregon minimum wage hike as protesters gather outside the Capitol in Salem.
And 10 inmates of the U.S. offshore prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were released to the country of Oman.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 14th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. The self-proclaimed environmental activist group, the Delta Five, is standing trial this week for blocking a mile-long fossil fuel train passing through the town of Everett, Washington, for 8 hours on September 2nd, 2014. The activists erected a large structure on the tracks and chained themselves to it. The trial is attracting national interest because it is believed to be the first time a necessity defense has been permitted to climate change activists. The necessity defense claims that the harm committed by blocking an oil train for 8 hours is insignificant against the arguably greater harm of allowing that oil train to contribute to climate change. However, today, after the defendants presented their necessity defense and before the jury began its deliberation, The judge retracted his allowance and instead instructed the jury to not consider the necessity aspect of the defense's testimony. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with Marla Markham, co-founder of the Climate Disobedience Center, who was at the trial.
My name is Marla Markham, and I'm one of the founders of the Climate Disobedience Center.
So could you please briefly describe the background of the climate activists being charged today and maybe talk about the specific action they took back in 2014 that has led to their arrest in this current trial?
Sure. So there are five defendants, and they all actually met one another, I think, in 2014, when each of them in their own way had come to sort of the end of their rope in their own attempts at trying to address climate change through the regular legal and regulatory means, through comment processes and feedback and voting and legal protests. And they all, each of them for their own reasons, had become so discouraged with what they felt like was the ineffectiveness of that way of approaching a problem that is so dramatically large that they had each come to a point where they decided they needed to take a different kind of action. And so they all sort of found each other. Some of them had already known each other. And they decided that what they really needed to do is to make a statement about both their displeasure about the idea that the Pacific Northwest is becoming a fossil fuel transport corridor to get coal and oil out to market, out to the international market, and to the dangers particularly of the oil trains running through their own communities. And they decided to block an oil train at the Delta Rail Yard in Everett. They used a device that looks like a tripod, and one of the members of the group, Abby Brockway, climbed to the top of the tripod, and her friends sat at the foot, at each of the feet, to protect Abby and to ground that device so that she would be protected. She was sitting about 20 feet above the ground, and they were there for 8 hours, blocking an oil train in the rail yard. They weren't blocking any other train traffic. And these trains are explosive. If your listeners remember the Lac Megantic explosion of an oil train in Quebec, I think in 2012, that destroyed the downtown of that small town and killed 47 people. And that was a safety issue. Some brakes failed, and these folks are concerned for rail workers and their safety, but also for the safety of communities. And so they were calling on BNSF not to cut conductors, but instead to commit to safety at the same time as saying, we appreciate rail and the opportunity for people to have jobs working in the rail yards and working on trains. We don't want to transport oil through our communities. These are bomb trains.
So the Delta 5 are now on trial for criminal activity they were arrested for in 2014. And could you tell us why this case is significant in the ongoing legal struggles between the fossil fuel industry and climate activists? Is it significant?
Yeah, it is. So no matter what happens from here, right now as I'm talking to you, the judge is instructing the jury. And the closing arguments are about to begin. So whatever happens from here, this trial is still really important because before it began, the judge allowed a thing called the necessity defense, which essentially allows the defendants to argue, to bring witnesses to the fact that the action that they took was necessary in order to prevent a greater harm. So while they're not denying that they broke the law, they are claiming that they took an action to avoid a greater harm that was imminent. And the judge allowed those arguments to be heard. And at the end of those arguments, then decided that he would not instruct the jury that they could consider that question. So that means that the jury will be told that they essentially need to forget about half of the defense testimony that they heard, that they can't consider any of the testimony from the expert witnesses who were not defendants, which I think is going to be difficult for them to do. And I think that that testimony is pretty well wrapped up in the substance of the defendant's own testimony. So it's going to be interesting to see how this works out. But so the, in a sense, the jury is not going to be instructed to consider necessity, which would have been our preference. But this is the first time in U.S. history that a jury has heard, has been allowed to hear arguments from necessity from witnesses during a trial. The interesting thing that happened is that the judge said very clearly that he understood that the political system was broken and that that it probably was more effective for these defendants to take the action that they took than taking action that is legal. And he said very clearly that the constraints, the legal constraints under which he's placed, don't allow him to make any ruling other than the ruling that he's making.
That was Marla Markham, one of the founders of Climate Disobedience Center. And this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
An interracial family in Salem, Oregon, is crowdfunding for a safe house after being driven from the city by threats from the Ku Klux Klan. The unidentified family has passed the halfway point in its fundraising effort and is temporarily staying with friends in Portland. This is from advocates from the Center for Intercultural Organizing. You can find the fundraising page at crowdrise.com/safehousingforsalem and F3. The harassment started back on January 6th, say advocates, with a late-night prowler. The family has received 3 death threats signed KKK. On Monday, the Salem police began investigating the case as a hate crime. The family said in a statement yesterday, "It is difficult to find words for what is happening to our family. To be hated and to have your life threatened based solely on the color of your skin is something that should never happen to any family. All we can do and what we are doing is to focus on keeping our children safe." In November, the Salem Statesman Journal reported that many local residents in Salem awoke to find Ziploc bags with candy and invitations to join the KKK dropped on their property.
The ongoing fight to raise the minimum wage nationwide has been particularly active in Oregon, where groups like 15 Now, PDX, Jobs with Justice, and a number of unions and political groups have been planning to bring a $15 wage initiative to the November ballot. But just this morning, Oregon Governor Kate Brown formally proposed her own, a gradual two-part plan that would raise Oregon's minimum wage to $13.50 and Portland's to $15.52 by the year 2022. After that year, the state minimum would go back to being based on the Consumer Price Index as it is now. Public comment concerning the governor's proposal and raising the minimum wage in general is being considered at 6 p.m. this evening at the Capitol Building, in a joint meeting of the House and Senate Labor Committees. Meanwhile, advocates for a $15 minimum wage, already mobilized by the ballot initiative campaign, met outside the state capitol this afternoon to make their voices heard. KBOO spoke with Jamie Partridge, a chief petitioner with the group Oregons for 15, just before the 2 o'clock rally.
Can you talk a little bit about Governor Brown's declaration this morning?
Well, we welcome this governor's intervention in the minimum wage conversation, and she's certainly raising the bar from the $13.50 proposal from the Speaker of the House, Tina Kotek, and we appreciate that, raising the bar to 15 for the Portland area, but it's not enough. Certainly a six-year phase-in is too long. We need 15 now. And the $13.50 for the rest of the state is this not adequate to bring workers out of poverty, not only do workers in Eugene need 15 workers, in Medford workers in Coos Bay, workers in LeGrand, workers in Ontario need 15. The studies show that to bring workers out of poverty and be self-sufficient, they need 15 in the state of Oregon. And in fact, in Portland, we need more than 15. We need the ability as a city or as a tri-county area to raise the wage above 15. And if you look at the federal guidelines for housing, which should be 30% of a person's income, the average apartment in Portland, the Portland area, one-bedroom apartment is $1,150. Well, 30% of that is basically a full-time $18 an hour, $19 an hour wage. And we need the ability to do that. And the governor's plan does not allow for lifting the preemption. Currently, there's a state preemption which prohibits cities from raising their own minimum wages. We've been advocating for that, and we need that so Portland can go higher.
Does the coalition supporting an immediate raise to $15, are they going to continue with their ballot initiative that was planned for November?
Well, it's actually not an immediate. It's a three-year phase in, 20% per year.
I see.
The first year to $11.50, the second year to $13.25, and the third year to $15. And we intend, well, the message we're bringing to Salem today is 15 now or the ballot. And, we're not here to beg or negotiate, just to inform not only the legislators, but the public and our opponents and our allies that 15 is what Oregon workers need. And if they don't get it, we're going to the ballot. And we have over 20,000 signatures. We need 88,000 valid signatures to get it on the ballot. We expect to have about 40,000 by the end of the month, about 60,000 by the end of February. And so we're well on our way to a July deadline of having enough signatures. And Oregon supports 15. There's three polls have come out showing that a majority of Oregonians would support $15 minimum wage.
Is there a significant presence there in the capital of people opposing the governor's plan?
You know, I can't tell you that. What I see is advocates, a sea of red T-shirts with 15 now. There's a big 3x5 poster board that's a mock-up of a signature sheet which says 88,000 signatures, 15 now or the ballot, and it's being delivered to the Speaker of the House office, and there's another one being delivered to the Senate President's office. There'll be a rally at 2, another one at 4, and then there'll be visits to all the Democrats to give them the word.
Jamie Partridge, thank you very much. I'll let you get to the rally.
Thank you.
For Cable Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman, and I've been speaking with Jamie Partridge, a chief petitioner with the group Oregonians for 15, which seeks to raise the state minimum wage to $15.
Most of the people rallying outside of Oregon's Capitol building are in favor of some sort of raise to $15, although they may disagree with the particulars of Governor Brown's plan. The opposition to a $15 minimum is less visible. In Oregon, much of it comes from business interests, including political organizations such as the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, the ORLA, which receives donations from hundreds of restaurants and hotels in the state. ORLA's Political Action Committee, PAC, has not declared any campaign finance activity in the new year, but simply may not have declared its expenditures yet. On the other side, one of the primary backers of an increase is the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, whose PAC, Political Action Committee, called Oregonians Need a Raise, recently received almost $350,000 from the union's international organization. It is the PAC's only recorded contribution so far. It's also not clear at this point where the real fight over the minimum wage will be, whether it'll be the legislature or the ballot. If Governor Brown's proposal goes to the legislature, there may be a slow phase-in of that plan. If Brown's proposal fails in the legislature, Oregonians can expect a lengthy and probably costly ballot measure fight ahead of the November elections.
A federal district judge in Oregon added trade groups affiliated with the oil and gas industry to the list of defendants in what's become known as the climate change lawsuit. The case was brought in the summer of 2015 and filed by a group of 21 children from around the country who claimed failure to address climate change is a violation of their constitutional rights. Back in November, three industry-related associations filed a motion with the court to intervene on behalf of the federal government, the only defendant at the time. The three new defendants are American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, the American Petroleum Institute, and the National Association of Manufacturers. Combined, these groups have spent more than $200 million in lobbying, according to Open Secrets. Oral arguments are scheduled for March 9th in Eugene.
Anyone wanting to pursue a career in the field of teaching may have to wait a while. KBOO's Lisa Loving has the story.
The website for Oregon's Teacher Standards and Practices Commission says that applications are now being processed for licensing paperwork filed in August of 2015. The site also says that no applications or payments are currently being accepted until next week because the commission is transitioning to an electronic system. A report released today by the Oregon State Auditor says the commission must do better. The report says the Bureau, quote, lacks clear expectations and accountability. The agency is an independent panel run by a 17-member commission. It licenses almost 20,000 teachers a year and investigates, an, on average, about 300 complaints against educators each year. But the audit says it needs to increase accountability to address substantial delays in its core services for teachers and other educators. The analysis found that for people who applied for their teaching licenses in July of last year, it took 4 months for the paperwork to clear. The timeline for investigations was even longer. The audit found the average inquiry into alleged teacher misconduct took an average of 14 months. Secretary of State Jeannie P. Atkins said, quote, our auditors found that TSPC lacks clear expectations and accountability for its performance at all levels. Last year, the state legislature approved an increase in teacher licensing fees that, the Secretary of State says, should increase staffing and help begin to address the issues. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the City of Portland public documents. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's Portland weather, morning rain with a high of 50 degrees. In the Willamette Valley, it will be rainy with highs near 50 degrees. And in the Columbia Gorge, cloudy with highs near 45 degrees. Today in history, in 1963, George C. Wallace was sworn in as governor of Alabama with the pledge, segregation forever. And the quote of the day is from LL Cool J, who said, when adversity strikes, that's when you have to be the most calm. Take a step back, stay strong, stay grounded, and press on.
It's 5:23 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wall Street buccaneer Carl Icahn has pocketed billions on deals, but he says he's now passionate about helping others. In particular, the corporate takeover specialist is pushing a charitable cause involving a group of people who, through no fault of their own, are being forced out of America. Poor refugees? No. Icahn weeps for the incomprehensible suffering of a small tribe of Americans, namely, the CEOs of several U.S.-based multinational corporations. Huh? Yes, he wails that poor super-rich chieftains of such profiteering giants as Pfizer Pharmaceuticals are having to move their corporate domains abroad, having been driven out of the USA by, quote, our uncompetitive tax code. These American-raised corporations have been raking in enormous profits on foreign sales, But the CEOs have whined that those profits should be exempt from U.S. taxation, since they're taxed by the countries where the products are sold. In fact, however, their double taxation claim is a fraud, for most of the $2.6 trillion in profits they're hiding have been stashed in offshore tax havens that assess as little as zero taxes. These rank corporate tax dodgers are starving America's essential public services of some $600 billion they owe in taxes. Yet Icahn sobs in print that they are victims. If these trillions are brought back home, he explains, they'll be taxed. So don't you see this, quote, forces CEOs to desert the U.S., moving their corporate citizenship to a place that doesn't make them pay for public services. Icahn insists that America must let the CEOs repatriate their foreign bounty by essentially forgiving the taxes they owe on it. That way, the corporations get the money and America gets to keep the corporations. This is Jim Hightower saying, but why should we want to keep scofflaw corporations that refuse to pay what they owe to America?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
The Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated announced it's agreed to pay a total of $5 billion to resolve an investigation over residential mortgage-backed securities between 2005 and 2007. Under the terms of this agreement, the financial services firm will pay $2.3 billion in civil penalties, and the larger half is to be provided for consumer relief. That relief is expected to be in the form of principal forgiveness for homeowners whose mortgage is what's called underwater, meaning more is owed on the home than what it's actually worth. Agencies agreeing to those terms and conditions include the U.S. Department of Justice and Attorneys General from both New York and Illinois.
Today, 10 Yemeni inmates of the U.S. offshore prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were released to the country of Oman. This brings the number of detainees held at the controversial facility down below 100. It is the largest transfer of prisoners out of the prison since immediately after President Barack Obama took office in 2009, on the heels of his as-yet-unfulfilled promise to close Guantanamo. All 10 of the inmates released today have been held without charge or trial for over 10 years. One of them, Fahad Ghazi, was only 17 years old when he was locked up at Guantanamo in 2002. For more on his story, including his murky route to Guantanamo Bay and what awaits him upon his return home, cable reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Alia Hussein, the advocacy director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represented Mr. Ghazi and a number of other Guantanamo inmates.
Fahad Ghazi was recently released from Guantanamo Bay. Can you give us a brief overview of his case?
Sure. So today we received news that Fahad Ghazi, along with nine other men, were transferred from Guantanamo to Yemen. We're really thrilled that today Fahad can begin his life. Fahad is one of CCR's clients. He arrived at Guantanamo in 2002 when he was just 17 years old. His story is very similar to that of many men at Guantanamo. He was picked up by Pakistani police, sold to the U.S., and then eventually brought to Guantanamo as a juvenile. He was cleared for release under George Bush in 2007 and again under President Obama in 2009, yet he spent nearly 14 years unjustly detained at Guantanamo.
It's confusing for a lot of people, I'm sure, but how is it that Mr. Ghazi and others like him could be held for so long after they were cleared for release?
So being cleared for release means that every national security agency, really with a stake in the national security, has unanimously agreed that a prisoner no longer needs to be detained. Yet the reason that Fahad and so many other men were detained for much longer after their clearance and continue to be detained is really just, it's about politics. It has less to do with what they have done and more to do with the political will of the president. So President Obama has not really demonstrated the political will necessary to transfer the majority of the men. We see this development today as a signal, hopefully, for more to come. But unfortunately, there's no reason that Fahad couldn't have gone home years ago.
At the end of this month, Guantanamo will have been open in its current incarnation for longer under Obama than under Bush. This is despite Obama's vow to close it in 2008. Mm-hmm. And what do you see as the future of Guantanamo under the next administration? Is there anything you can predict?
You know, ideally, if I'm going to be an optimist, I would hope that Guantanamo is closed before we see a new president. It's possible. There is 1 year left if President Obama demonstrates that he's willing to put his full weight and authority into transferring all the cleared men. Right now, there are 34 men cleared for release. If he's able to speed up the periodic review boards, which are an administrative process that determines whether people can be cleared for release, if he can do a number of things and basically order the Defense Department and work together with other agencies to get these men either repatriated or resettled, it's very possible that we can see an end to Guantanamo. It'll take a lot of hard work, but like I said, political will is really what's necessary at this point.
And I guess lastly, what awaits Fahad Ghazi when he returns home?
So right now, Fahad is in Oman, and Oman has really shown an incredible humanitarian gesture by accepting 10 men this week, and last year they accepted a handful more as well. We hope that Fahad's future is bright. He speaks English fluently. He loves to read. He's always wanted to go to university to learn, to get a job, and be reunited with his family. So we hope that is in the cards for him, and he really has so much promise, and we hope that he can be reunited with his family, get a great job, and just live peacefully. We have a short film, which is about 12 minutes, which is really beautiful interviews with Fahad's family back in Yemen.
Okay, Aliyah Hussein of the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman, speaking with Aliyah Hussein of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The video mentioned by Ms. Hussein is called Waiting for Fahad. It can be found at ccrjustice.org.
The Supreme Court of the United States refused a request by Nestle and two other companies to dismiss a lawsuit brought by victims of child slavery from the Ivory Coast. The decision upheld the ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Northern California, decided in December of 2014. The plaintiffs contend the companies aided and abetted violations of human rights as companies that purchased cocoa from farmers in the area, even though they were aware of inhumane and cruel conditions for the young workers. The other two defendants named are Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill Incorporated. Collectively, the companies have received state and federal subsidies of nearly $8 billion, according to Good Jobs First. A date for the case to return to California was unavailable in time for tonight's broadcast.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Detroit Federation of Teachers says the community needs real answers to the Detroit Public Schools crisis. The teachers say deplorable teaching and learning conditions that include serious health and safety issues need to be addressed by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and his hand-appointed emergency manager, Darnell Early. Detroit schools were closed this week when teachers called in sick. It was an effort to get their voices heard about mold and rodents in the schools, big class sizes, and physical deterioration of school buildings. Detroit Federation of Teachers President Ivy Bailey.
Children should be our number one priority. The children in Detroit deserve a quality education like everyone else. I think we've all done a disservice to the children here in the city. The teachers are speaking out, and I think their voices need to be heard.
The teachers are holding a mass membership meeting Thursday in Detroit, where AFT President Randy Weingarten and Michigan AFT President David Hecker will speak as the teachers continue their fight for Detroit schools and students. Wheaton College is in the midst of terminating political science professor Dr. Larisha Hawkins as students and alumni protest and pray for reconciliation, lamenting the action against her. They want Dr. Hawkins reinstated with tenure immediately. Dr. Hawkins was targeted for termination after she publicly donned a headscarf resembling an Islamic hijab and expressed solidarity with Muslims during Advent. In her statement, she said, quote, I stand in solidarity with women wearing the hijab as I think Jesus would, as he came to embody what it means to love neighbor and love God and love yourself, end quote. One alumnus of the campus who requested anonymity for this story says what's unfolding at Wheaton College is a micro microcosm of the larger national picture of religious intolerance being fueled by terrorism and political reaction to it.
We are praying for wisdom on behalf of the administration. We're hoping and we're praying that justice would be done in the situation, that everyone would feel that they're treated equally and fairly. We would pray that in this entire situation that the world would see what reconciliation means and that disagreements can be had. But at the end, the most important thing is that we would love one another. Jesus says to all of us, he says, they will know you, and he's speaking to his disciples, they will know you by your love for each other. Are we showing love to each other is the question.
In a statement, Wheaton College said that actions against Dr. Hawkins resulted from theological statements that seemed inconsistent with Wheaton College's doctrinal convictions. Students and alumni supporting Dr. Hawkins are questioning the transparency of the college's actions and want more specifics about exactly why Dr. Hawkins is being terminated.
Now those questions are being asked by the faculty publicly as well, and that's, why are you releasing Larisha? With all the facts that we know, what are the grounds for her termination right now? And those have not been made explicit.
WIN is made possible in part with support from the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
ISIL has claimed responsibility for yesterday's bomb and gun attacks carried out against civilians and police officers in the heart of Indonesia's capital city, Jakarta. Indonesian officials have said that five plainly clothed men opened fire with handguns into crowds after several small bombs were detonated in a crowded shopping district. A police traffic post was destroyed by a hand grenade. Two civilians were killed in the attacks, a Canadian and an Indonesian, and 23 bystanders were injured. Five of the ISIL militants were shot and killed by nearby police, while some gunmen were believed to have escaped on motorbike. Jakarta's police chief, Tito Karnavian, told Reuters news agency that a known Indonesian member of ISIL in Syria, Bahru Naim, was believed to be behind the attack. Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country, and though it has been the site of previous bombings by other terrorist organizations, yesterday's attack is believed to be the first by ISIL on a Muslim-majority country.
In Syria, civilians are starving because international food aid is being blocked by sieges in isolated areas. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says that is a war crime. Aid convoys have taken months to reach three towns shut down by fighting, where many residents, including children, have died from hunger. Ban Ki-moon said today, quote, "Let me be clear. The use of food as a weapon of war is a war crime." Meanwhile, the United States, Russia, the Syrian military, and the Saudi military are all currently dropping bombs on the nation of Syria.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imenc.org, for Thursday, January 14th, 2016. Two Palestinians killed by Israeli gunfire in the West Bank, and in Gaza, troops target farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Thursday a young Palestinian man close to the Beit Anun junction east of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Palestinian medical sources said that the slain Palestinian has been identified as Muayyad Auni Jabarin, 20, from Sa'ir town northwest of Hebron. The Israeli army claimed that soldiers thwarted an attack when the young man attempted to stab them, causing no injuries among the troops. Palestinian eyewitnesses said that Jabarin was executed by the soldiers, who fired more than several live rounds at him. After shooting Jabarin, the soldiers kept him bleeding on the ground and prevented Palestinian medics from approaching him. Jabarin is the 12th Palestinian from Sa'ir town alone to be killed by the Israeli army since October 1, 2015. Following the fatal shooting, clashes took place between the soldiers and dozens of local youth who hurled stones and empty bottles on them. The soldiers fired gas bombs, live rounds, and rubber-coated steel bullets. Also in Hebron, the soldiers demolished an under-construction Palestinian home in Za'atara area east of Beit Umar town, northwest of the city. Later on Thursday midday, Israeli soldiers killed a young Palestinian man at a military roadblock north of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The slain Palestinian has been identified as Haytham Yassin, 36, from Asira al-Shamaliya town, north of Nablus. The Israeli army also claimed that the Palestinian stabbed the soldier and described the injury of the soldier as very light. On Thursday at dawn, Israeli forces abducted at least 18 Palestinians from across the occupied West Bank during pre-dawn invasions. In the Jordan Valley, Israeli forces demolished four greenhouses and a water well owned by Palestinian farmers. Elsewhere, Israeli occupation forces opened fire Thursday morning at Palestinian farmers east of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. Farmers told local media that soldiers fired a hail of bullets towards them in Al-Karara area east of Khan Yunis city. No injuries were reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, January 14th, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan and Ethan Martin. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer holding it all together is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sari Kametha. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, hosts Ani and Lynn discuss the many catastrophic effects of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. At 9, on Veterans Voice, Angie and Marvin interview five female war veterans who are part of the play Breaking Rank, a project of Well Arts in partnership with Returning Veterans Project and Wise Counsel and Comfort. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Radio Zine features a special town hall meeting that was held to deal with issues related to health, finance, school, housing, and other issues as a result of the Porter Ranch methane gas leak. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland Mayor Hales rushed an item onto yesterday's City Council agenda, challenging the Multnomah County District Attorney's order in the petition of Mark Bartlett. KABU's Joe Meyer filed this report.
It turns out that Mr. Bartlett had a request for information denied by the city. Last week, the Multnomah County District Attorney, Rod Underhill, ordered the city to disclose the information. And yesterday, City Council voted 4-1 in favor of Hale's proposal to use taxpayer money to fight the release of 25-year-old public information. According to documents received by KABU, What is at stake is the legality of the ongoing destruction of Portland's open reservoirs at Washington Park and Mount Tabor. Even Steve Novick, who voted no, seems to want to keep the information secret. He is quoted in the Oregonian as saying that he doesn't see a way around it and the law should be changed. Mr. Bartlett's volunteerism around the issue began in 2006 when Portland Parks, under Dan Saltzman, entered negotiations to sell part of Mount Tabor to Warner Pacific. Mr. Bartlett knows of the existence and likely content of the contested documents through a 2002 memo from Water Bureau employee Dan Coombs. Here's my conversation with Mark Bartlett, recorded earlier today.
Yeah, this started on Mount Tabor in 2006 when we found the document about the secret sale to Warner Pacific. Randy Leonard then authorized us to conduct free public record requests for a number of months, and we sure did a lot of
requests. Now, Randy Leonard, what was it? Was he water at that point?
He was Water Bureau. He was mad at Dan for trying to sell the property.
And Dan was what, Parks? Okay.
So then we had this big group meeting for 2 years to discuss the redevelopment of the yard and redo the master plan. And this document came up because of the discussion over the ownership in the parks.
Right. So both Parks and Water somehow co-own or own different parts of Mount Tabor. And what prompted your initial investigation was the selling of part of that to Warner Pacific?
Right. We started digging in, and then during those meetings, an engineer named Marianne Ellen Collentine, she's a senior Water Bureau engineer, started discussing the ownership issue with me and referred me to Dan, whom I then met at Water Bureau offices, and he gave me a bunch of documents and maps. Those I brought to our group, and we started discussing them. And it was determined that this issue needed clarification because they had not yet done so. Dan provided me with a bunch of maps and deed records, which I brought to the group, and that became then part of the master plan update.
And this also has implications for the reservoir work going on now at Mount Tabor.
It does. Sometime in the Potter administration, it seemed the city decided that they were going to call all of the city property indistinct under one legal entity. Contrary to what Dan's memo says, that there are distinct bureaus and you cannot commingle dissimilar bureau assets. That's also written in the city charter in a section under finance 6.11. These records are required to be